With the recording on? And I will put everybody on temporary mute. Feel free to unmute as you wish and share screen. Okay, we're good? Everybody see the screen? Okay, oh, and this is the source page I sent out this morning, but I'll display it here for what we need. And we are starting Perek Tet Vav. We are moving along. Can't quite say flying through. Not quite a snail's pace, but we're getting there. But Perek Tet Vav is the beginning of the rebellion, the beginning of what we refer to in the Navi as Mered Avshalom, Avshalom's rebellion. Against David and an attempt to coup d'etat against David to try to take the kingdom, which is partially successful for a period of time, that leads ultimately to a great civil war between the forces of David and the forces of Avshalom. Eventually, it leads to the death of Avshalom and David's return to the throne in Yerushalayim. So it's really quite a tumultuous period of time. Everything that we have studied up until this point in terms of the story of David and Bathsheba, as well as the story of Amnon and Tamar, and the Avshalom's vengeance and his exile and subsequent return, all of the pieces we've had up until now have sort of been leading up to this moment when the rebellion begins in earnest. But I will also tell you that if you look at the rest of Sefer Shmuel from a bird's eye view, the remaining chapters of the story of Sefer Shmuel all focus on this event and its aftermath. So essentially, the remaining chapters of Sefer Shmuel, just going to do a quick survey through them. Perek Tet Vav is the beginning of the rebellion. Perek Tet Zayin, David exiles himself from Yerushalayim. There's a couple of encounters along the way. We'll get to them. Perek Yud Zayin is Avshalom and Yerushalayim and his consultation with his advisors and ultimately goes to war against David. Perek Yudchet, the war begins in earnest out in Yar Ephraim. Perek Yudtet, and is after the war is over, Avshalom is killed. David kind of brings himself back from the mourning over Avshalom, and he begins to rebuild his following. And Perek Chaf, rebellion number two, which is a subset of rebellion of Avshalom, rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri, we'll get to it. And then eventually David finds himself back in Yerushalayim. And Perek Chaf ends with a kind of summary of where David is in life. He's back in Yerushalayim and back to the leader of the people, back to his position as king. And Yoav was the head of the army of Israel. Benaya ben Yoyada was in charge of the Kreti Uplati, which we'll talk about as a kind of a term that mystifies many, but it's more or less probably some sort of a military group within the army. Adoram Alamas, Adoram was in charge of the taxes. Yoshafat ben Achilud Maskir, Yoshafat was the recorder. Ushiva Sofer, there was a scribe. Sadok v'Avyatar Kohanim, they were the priests. And Iraha Ya'iri was the Kohen for David. And more or less, what you end up with at the end of this parak is a summary of the picture of where David is at the end of Sefer Shmuel. David is on the throne, and these are the people who are advising him and running his kingdom. And you kind of have this, it's not quite, and they lived happily ever after, but that's sort of the summary of the Sefer. From here, if we went to Malachim Aleph, Perek Aleph, I'm just going to actually do that real fast. If we went to, from that story, went to Malachim Aleph. What's going on with my internet? Malachim Aleph, Perek Aleph. it would start, V'amelech David zaken ba'ba yamim, David is old, and he needs to establish an heir to the throne because Adoniyahu is going to declare himself king if he doesn't. More or less, that's the end of Sefer Shmuel. Why do I paint this picture? There are still four prakim left in Sefer Shmuel post this story. However, as Chazal read them linearly, so the many midrashim will see, they'll sort of calculate in the chronology the remaining four chapters as part of the story of Sefer Shmuel. But almost all the mafarshim, I think it's sort of a general consensus, agree that the remaining four chapters of Shmuel are much earlier. They're a postscript to the text, to the book. They are earlier events that are kind of lumped into an epilogue for various reasons. They're here instead of where they belong historically. One is the story of the famine for 3 years and the Givonim and the burial of Shaul, a story we looked at quite a while ago, but that's certainly much earlier in the story of sequence of events. Perek Chav Bet is David's song, which is right out of Tehillim, song of victory, which he sings when God saved him from the hands of all his enemies and the hand of Shaul. So clearly this is a much earlier story. Perek Chav Gimel is the list of all of David's warriors, all his whole army, all of the major players in David's world are listed here. And then Perek Chav Daled is a kind of a David is king and he is tempted by his power and he goes and he takes a census of the army against Yoav's greater council and the rest of this parak that deals with the aftermath of that transgression. These four stories are a postscript to the Sefer. Almost every scholar agrees that they're much earlier for various reasons. And we'll talk, when we get to that part of the book, we'll talk about why they're inserted there and interrupt the flow. Why do I mention all of that? Because from chapter 15 to chapter 20, so you have chapter 15, chapter 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, six chapters, essentially all revolving around the story of Avshalom's rebellion and its aftermath. So why I'm presenting it this way is because I want us to understand that we are now starting sort of the last piece of Sefer Shmuel. And the longest single story or event in the book. And this is the longest single event that is described. It's not the longest chronologically, but it's certainly in terms of its detail. It is the longest event described in the Sefer. And from that perspective, really one of the most dramatic. When you think about the notion that here we have David Melech Yisrael, we have the, you know, David to us who looms so large, who is almost larger than life, who is the description of Melech HaMashiach, or the progenitor of the Messianic line, Davidic line. That there should be a coup, a rebellion against him, and an attempt, and actually a dethrone him, a successful attempt to remove him from the throne. And only by circumstances, which we will study in depth, does he end up returning. It's really an extraordinary turn of events. It will show us David both in his vulnerability as well as in his strength. And many of the pieces, the aftermath of the story of Bathsheba and Avshalom and Amnon and Tamar, all these pieces kind of pull together. But there's no question that the rebellion of Avshalom is one of the most dramatic events, if not in Sefer Shmuel, if not in all of Tanakh, certainly in Sefer Shmuel. So having said that, we're going to dive right in. The only difference is I'm not going to read through the whole parak because now it gets very complex. A lot of different moving parts. So we're going to take them piece by piece. So let's start with the first couple of psukim. Vahim yach rechen, vayas lo avshalom merkava besusim v'chamishim ish ratzim lefanav. Came to pass after this that Avshalom prepared for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. I'll come back to each of these psukim and what they mean in a moment. Vishkim Avshalom Amad Ayad Derech Hashar. Avshalom rose up early or would rise up early, meaning this is not just a one-time occurrence. As we'll see from the end of this description that this is an occurrence that is described as having happened once and then extrapolated as kind of a daily occurrence. And he would stand at the gate of the way of the gate, or the road to the gate. Any person who would have a grievance, a dispute, and would come to the king for adjudication, like the Ishat Kuit we studied over the last couple of weeks did. Avshalom would call to them and say to them, tell me, where are you from? What city? And they would respond, I'm from one of the cities of Israel, wherever it is, Tzfat, Tveria, Chatzor, whatever the city is. Avshalom would say to them, I see your matters, that which your conflict, your dispute, that you come here for judgment. Your matters are tovim u'nechochim, are good and right. I agree with you. I think that you are right. I think whoever has wronged you in this case is it wrong, and you are in the right in this particular claim. However, says Avshalom to this person he's just met, Shomea ein lecha me'et ha-melech. Know that there is nobody representing the king who will give you the ear to hear you and with whom it will resonate. There's no one home. The king is not going to respond to you. And when you start repeating that message over and over again, the message expands. Vayomer Avshalom, Me yisimeni shofet ba'aretz. Would that I would be the judge in the land. Let anybody who has a dispute or a cause or a case come to me. Vitztaktiv, I would bring him justice. I would do him justice. And that would be the routine. Vayabikrav ishtachavotlo, so that when the man came near to bow down to him, he's the crown prince, or not the crown prince, but he's the prince. Certainly, he's dressed in the garb of the prince. Shalach et yado, would set forth his hand and take him. Vechaziklo, and he would grab him. Vinashaklo, and he would embrace him, and he would kiss him. Meaning of shalom to this total stranger who is come to the king. And Vayas Avshalom Kadavar Hazel Lucho Yisrael Ashiyavol Mishpat Al Melech. So too did Avshalom do for all of Israel that came to the king for judgment. Meaning, here's one example, and now extrapolate it over and over and over again. Vayiganev Avshalom Et Lev Anshei Yisrael, and in so doing, Avshalom stole the hearts of Israel. Okay, for now, that's going to be our challenge for tonight. This next piece is the actual rebellion in earnest. We'll get there, if not today, next week. Okay, let's go back. Starting from the beginning. After these things, after what things? So first of all, let's just understand context. What are we linking this story to? I pause. That's a indicator to unmute and chime in, right? What's the Yachrechen? What are we linking this to?
He wouldn't see him.
Initially, he wouldn't see him for 2 years. Initially, he put him into exile. But after his little conflict with between Avshalom and Yoav comes to the king again, the end of that perek reads, Ve'yavor le'melech, he's granted an audience with the king. Ve'yishtachulo, he bows to him. Alav havarza, lifnei ha'melech, he bows before the king. Ve'yishak ha'melech le'avshalom. And the king kissed Avshalom. And in that act, in that kiss, seen by all as a kind of almost royal pardon, if not for the transgression itself, but certainly a commuting of his sentence, And Avshalom is now free to come and go. Well, you allow Avshalom to come and go. What do you find? Okay, so he'll come and he'll go. Horses, chariots, 50 men running before him, sitting in exile and under house arrest. Avshalom is not gathering horses and chariots and 50 men to run before him. However, bring him, give him, commute a sentence or give him a royal pardon, and suddenly Avshalom is free to put on his royal garments, stand by the court of the king, stand in the presence of a chariot and horses and 50 men running before him. So let's spend a moment and talk about what this means, this chariot and horses and 50 men running before him. What is the reference here? What is 50 men running before? What does that mean?
He's in war.
Excuse me?
He's ready to fight.
So I don't think this is a call to arms yet. That we'll get to. That he'll blow the shofar later down the rest of the parak. We'll see in Pasuk Yud.
Is 50 men a large or small number?
Back in Pasuk Yud, he'll say, "Kishamachem et kol hashofar." He'll make that call to arms and declaration with a shofar blast later in the parak. Right now, I've got a horse and I've got horses and chariots and 50 men running before him.
Isn't that symbolic of like royalty or being? Oh,
so it sounds very much like a kind of almost ceremonial entourage, almost like a royal motorcade. Think for a moment of the head of state driving in a motorcade and a couple of motorcycles driving before them with the flag and before in front, right? That kind of royal guard or indigo, right? Once he's back in his position, so now he has a kind of a royal position, horses and chariots and men running before him. This is a phenomenon which we'll see actually a few places in Tanakh. I'll show you a couple of examples. I'm actually put them on the, let's look at them here. Malachim Aleph, Perek Aleph is the rebellion, beginning of the Book of Kings, the rebellion of Adoniel. Avshalom is dead, right? And David is dying on the end of his life. And Adoniel ben Chagit decides that he's going to make himself king. Mit naser lemor, he makes declaration, ani emloch, I am going to be king. And so in order to mount this claim that Adoniyahu says, I'm going to be king instead of Shlomo, who David had appointed, v'yas lo rechev u'parashim mechamishim ish ratzim lefanav. It's almost the exact same language. He prepared chariots and horses and 50 men before him. Now, we don't have any other kind of precedent for 50 men, but I suspect that Adoniyahu took a page out of Avshalom's book. Avshalom's story begins with horses, chariots, and 50 men, a 50-man entourage, like a 50-gun salute, right? 50-man entourage or motorcade. So Adoniyahu decides he's going to establish for himself that same kind of motorcade. It's an expression of dignity, an expression of royalty. Think another story that's reminiscent of the same idea is Mordechai and Haman. Story of the riding on the horse. There it's not a king, because Haman's not suggesting that they put the king on the horse, but they're suggesting that they put somebody of dignitary on the horse, and the servant who walks before him to declare that this is a person of special status. Right? That kind of moment, that kind of motorcade, that kind of men running before him. So extrapolate from one to 50 and from one horse to horses and chariots, and suddenly you get the sense that this is a kind of a public demonstration of I'm of status. Remember, the issue here is not Avshalom wants to be king. The issue is that Avshalom wants to be declared the next king, right? So that's part of the tension, is that this whole episode could have easily been just ended, silenced, and put to bed. David would have simply said to Avshalom, I declare you heir to the throne. David was not prepared to do that under any circumstances. And so Avshalom decides to take that on his own and prepares the horses and chariots and 50 men to establish himself, not as the king, but as the rightful successor, which is why he makes this proclamation, Mi yisimeni shofet baretz, would that I would be made judge in the land. Meaning, David is not going to be around forever. Who's going to take over for him? Some guy who's going to follow in David's footsteps? Or me, who, and we'll talk about what Avshalom brings to the table more than David did or could at that moment. The other interesting thing about this Merkavah v'susim v'chamishim ish ratzim lefanav is that we have another very powerful moment of similar status, this notion of running before the king, ratz lefanav, running before the king. This is a very famous episode of... of Eliyahu Hanavi and Ahav, of all people. Ahav was the king, idolatrous king. Eliyahu was the Navi. They have that famous showdown on Mount Carmel over the rain and over idolatry. And it ends with the rains themselves coming after a three-year drought and pouring down. And at the end of that parak, which is Malachim Allah, parak Yilchet, we find that the waters opened up, the sky, the heavens open up. Shemayim hitkadru, the heavens grew black with clouds, hitkadru avim, v'ruach v'yi geshem gadol, it was great rain, and so v'yirkav achav, v'yelach Yisrael, the rain started to run, and Achav ran back to Yisrael, or rode back to Yisrael, which is the valley where his palace is in the Shomer. They were on Mount Carmel, the rain started, not a good place to get caught when it starts to rain. Don't want to be on the top of the mountain with a chariot when the rain starts and you have to get down the valley. That is just not a smart move. Sort of reminds me, Eugene and Elena, you still on the call? It sort of reminds me of that Shabbos we spent years ago out in where was that Arachim seminar? In the mountains of in the Rocky Mountains and Matzah Shabbos, we had to drive down in the ice, right? Not a clever thing, not a thing you want to do. Right? Here's Achav sitting on the top of the mountain, and he gets caught in the rain. Bayad Hashem aita el Eliyahu, bayishanes motnav bayaratz lifnei Achav ad bo'acha Yisrael. God assisted, the hand of God was with Eliyahu, he girded his loins, and he ran before Achav to the entrance of Yisrael. So, to the Jezreel Valley. So, what does this mean? So, on a simple level, I would understand this to mean that God assisted Achav to run to Eliyahu so that he could get to Emek Yisrael before Achav, could beat him to it. But I needed a little bit of kvitzas haderech, a little bit of a shortcut that God provided. However, Chazal were very attuned to this phrase, v'yarotz lifnei Achav, he ran before Achav. What does it mean to run before the king? And so Chazal make the following declaration, which is really quite astounding. Kadosh Baruch Hu amar lo, Kadosh Baruch Hu makes the following statement, chalok kavod l'machut, always provide honor and dignity to the king, no matter who and no matter where. As it says, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe v'Aharon, God commanded Moshe, telling him to go to Paro. And we'll talk, that's one example of honor that he provided to Paro. Yosef provided honor to Paro by saying, Deo Lokim Yanet Shlom Paro, God will provide the answer to Paro's dream, offering, speaking to Paro in third person with an expression of dignity. Yaakov also gave kavod l'malchut, honor to the king, as it says that when he was on his deathbed and he was sick, Yosef, in the capacity as the viceroy of Egypt, entered, and vayitchazek Yisrael vayeshev al amita, Yaakov stood up. V'chein Eliyahu, chilek kavod l'malchut, and so Eliyahu conducted himself with honor and dignity towards the king, as it says, "Vayarotz lifnei Achav." by running before Achav. And so you have this vision in the Medrash, the Mechilta, the Gemara and Zvachim that uses the same example, the reverence, fear, Eimat HaMelech. And the Mefarshim, like the Radak, suggests that that's exactly what it means, that he was Vayiratz Lifnei Achav, that he ran before Achav's chariot. Achav is the king, and Eliyahu, the Navi, who was at war with Achav, but he's running before Achav's chariot. Why? Because that's how you paid honor and dignity to the king. It's really a fascinating piece of the story. Again, I don't think it's, I could offer an alternative shot to the phrase, Vayaretz Lifnei Achav, but I think Chazal were very attuned to its particular nuance as an expression of honor or dignity to walk or to run before the king. In the case of Avshalom, he has horses, chariots, and 50 people running before him as an expression of, right, the dignity, the honor, the kvod hamelech for Avshalom. The other irony of this pasuk is that if we're looking at the beginning of the most dramatic abuse of the position of melech, rebellion, treasonous rebellion against the authority of the king, that would take us all the way back to the beginning of the roots of Malchut Yisrael, which are, of course, Shmuel HaNavi's chastisement of the people when they asked for a king. And the whole notion of a king in Israel is complicated. And there were many commentary, and there many, including the Navi, who was opposed to the establishment of a king. Just as a FYI, what was the alternative to a king in Israel? What was the... there's a mitzvah in the Torah to appoint a king. Some controversy as to whether or not it was needed, necessary, important, valuable. What's the alternative to a melech?
Shofet.
Right. The mistake people think is assuming that the alternative to a king or monarchy is a republic or a democracy. That's a modern concept. In biblical terms, there is no such thing as a leadership that isn't, that doesn't hold within them the powers of both military and judiciary. That's what a leader was. They ran, they were the military leader and they were the judge or the head of the mishpat. The only difference between the melech and what came before the melech is whether the leadership was A, appointed or spontaneous, in the case of a shofet, or inherited as in the case of a melech. But the other difference was whether or not the leadership was local, whether that local was tribal, as a nasi, or regional, like a shofet, or whether it was national, as it was by a melech. And the other difference is that because it was national, because it was inherited, the role of a king was to establish not just a defense against a particular momentary enemy, but long-term to establish an army that would defend the people of Israel. So that's the main difference. From the period of the Shoftim to the period of the kings, we went from having an ad hoc military militia called upon by a regional leader when the need arose, to a king with a military standing army. Foundationally, that's the difference. And so when Shmuel turns to the people and he says, "Do you understand what it means to have a king?" We're talking now decades earlier, before Shaul, right? When the people come to him and they say, "We want the king." And they come to him and they say, "Tna lanu melech l'shofteinu," we want the king to judge us, to lead us. And Shmuel gets very angry at them. And he says to them, "Kol divrei Hashem al ha'am," this is what he says to them, "Ze yiyeh mishpat ha'melech," you understand the laws of the king. "Hashem loch alechem." A king operates differently than a shofet. And this is the difference. And there are many who suggest that what Shmuel actually outlines for the people is not just an abuse of the role of the king, but actually authorities that the king has because he's creating a standing permanent army. And the first in that list is, "Et b'nechem yikach v'sam lo b'merkavto u'b'farashav." He'll take your children, your sons, and place them in his chariots and upon his horses. V'ratzu lifnei merkavto, and they shall run before his chariot. Somebody just a moment ago talked about, right, as a symbol of war. Right? And Barbara, you mentioned, right, preparation for war. The notion of creating an army means you create a situation where the melech is the head of state and all the dignity that comes with it. So you've got your sons and your and riding in his chariots or in his tanks and on his horses or in his planes, and ratzu lifnei merkavto, and they're running before his chariot. That's exactly what Avshalom describes. Merkava v'susim chamishim ish ratzim lefanav, with 50 people running before him. So there's a direct link. It's almost like we go from Shmuel Aleph, Perek Chet, and the abuse of the kingship as described by Shmuel, potentially, to the rebellion of Avshalom, which begins with exactly that description. Horses, chariots, and the men of Israel running before Avshalom. Can you imagine? Think for a second about David. Did David ever have horses and chariots and men of Israel as a form of dignity and respect and honor to the king running before David? Can you imagine that scene with regards to David? Picture for a moment David returning the ark to Yerushalayim and the ark moving through the parade of Israel, and David not on his horse, not on his chariots, not in his motorcade, rather David on the street dancing before the ark. That's David. That's precisely why Michal has such a hard time with it. She doesn't like that scene. But that's David. Can you imagine Avshalom? It's a totally different world. Suddenly Avshalom is doing exactly what Shmuel predicted how many decades ago. Horses and chariots and men of Israel running before him, and honor guard and motorcade and all the pomp and ceremony without the substance. David is all substance without the pomp and ceremony. It's the exact opposite image. It's so powerful. And all of this, lasum l'shavei alafim, sarei chamishim, l'chvash chamisho, v'liktzok tzivo, v'lasot klei milchamto, klei michbo, in order to bring captains and thousands and captains of 50s and instruments of war and instruments of chariots, and his sons he'll take to his army, and his your daughters he'll take as perfumers and cooks and bakers, because of course an army runs on its stomach. Etzdotechem et kamechem ezetechem atovim yikach, he'll take your fields, he'll take your vineyards, he'll tax your people, because of course an army needs funding, and so you'll have taxes from the king. All of this starts with the pomp and ceremony of Merkavto Parashav V'ratzu Lifnei Merkava. And that's precisely what Shmuel describes. Precisely what we find with Avshalom. Horses, chariots, men running before him. It's a very different world. We've entered into a very different arena of Malchut, an attempt to become the king of Israel.
It doesn't sound very religious.
It's
based on God, based on King.
Correct. That's exactly it's not a compliment. It's not a compliment to Avshalom, and it's not a compliment to Adoniyahu, and nor is it a compliment to Ahab, right? It's very, it's kind of, David, on the other hand, reflects the spiritual depth of David running before, if I had to, the contrast, come back to that contrast for a second. If I had to describe a moment in which there is a juxtaposition of a king, a parade, and running. Those three words, king, parade, running. The image of David is a parade of the ark going to Yerushalayim and David running before the ark. The image of Avshalom is Avshalom in his horse and his chariot and his motorcade sitting upon the top of the car, waving to the crowds while the men of Israel are running before him. That's exactly the difference between these two pictures. And it's one of those moments where the image tells the whole story. V'ishkim Avshalom v'amad al yad derech hashar. Avshalom goes and he stands at the gate of the road to the gate. So obviously he's going to the court, he's going to the Beit Mishpat, he's going to where he's going to encounter people who are coming to the king for adjudication, for judgment, and he's going to intervene. This is described as Derech HaSha'ar. Why it's described as Derech HaSha'ar is simply a function of language in Tanakh. The gate here is a classic biblical reference to every city that had a central access point or the gate of the city, in which you had two phenomena that stood at the entrance or the gates of every city. One is the market. Okay, the Sha'ar was where the market took place. The major thoroughfare. And the other was that's where the courts would establish themselves. That was the place of the Mishpat. I'll show you a couple of references. You'll see it right away. Beginning of Sefer, beginning of Parshat Shoftim in Dvarim. Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'chol sharecha. Judges and officers, establish for yourself in all of your gates. Again, the gate is a reference to the city. So in all of your gates means in all of your cities, you shall have a court system. But it also is a physical location because the courts were always near the gates. The case of the Ben Soro Mora, the Tafsuba Avivi Movatsu Oto El Zikne Iro, his parents would take him to the place of the elders, the Mishpat, the Beitin, the El Sha'ar Mikomo, which was at the gate of his place. You have it at the beginning of Megillat, at the end of Megillat Ruth, when Boaz negotiates with Ploni Amoni for the buyback of the field and the kinyan with Ruth. It says, Boaz Allah Hasha'ar. Boaz went up to the gate, and there he sat, and the goel of the Redeemer passed by, and he says to him, come here, Ploni Amoni, let's sit, we'll negotiate. And there, of course, is the elders of the people. Sorry, I apologize for that. The elders are there, the Ziknei Ha'ir. Another reference in Sefer Amos, Sinura, despise evil, Evu Tov, love good, V'yatzigu b'sha'ar mishpat, and present judgment in the gates. So the Mefarshim explained, because the gates was makom moshav ha'shoftim me'azkenim, that's where the elders sat. That's not an accident. Why would you put the court near the market?
It's where the people were.
A, it's where the people were, but take it one step further.
That's where the conflicts would occur.
Correct. That's where the conflicts would occur. It's different than today's world. Today's when you want to go to court, you have to have a docket, you have to have an application, you have to have lawyers, you have to have this, right? Until you get to court, it could take months, if not years. In those days, two people had a fight over, you sold me a horse and delivered a cow, to borrow the phrase from Fiddle on the Roof, or whatever the context was. So you went to the rabbi, you went to the Beit Din, you went to the court, you turned right instead of left. You were standing in the market, two people having a fight about the weights and measures. You cheated me, you didn't cheat me. Yes, it was weighing 5 pounds, it was 5 kilos, it was 6 kilos. Let's go sort it out. They went to the Beit Din. That's exact. And they went to the court, so they were right there. I actually think, you know, the closest analogy to this picture is fascinating. The closest analogy we have to this picture is Sha'ar Yafo in Yerushalayim. Because Sha'ar Yafo, besides being enormous, right, is a big thoroughfare, at main access to the old cities through Sha'ar Yafo. You have a big public thoroughfare, all the stores that are there. It's also the beginning of the market, the shuk, that leads from the entrance. And if you turn right, what do you see? As you come into Sha'ar Yafo, the main headquarters of the Jerusalem police. The police force is sitting right there. I don't think they intended it to reflect this idea, but it's just like one of those very powerful pictures of exactly this idea. In the Sha'ar, you have the Mishpat and you have the Shuk. That's exactly the two things that you have. So Avshalom now wants to go stand in front of the courthouse. So he goes, you have it in Megillat Esther too. You have Mordechai Yoshev B'Sha'ar HaMelech. When Mordechai is trying to kind of intervene in the whole story, Mordechai Yoshev B'Sha'ar HaMelech. He's sitting in the gate of the people. He's sitting by the courts. V'hi kol ish she'yeh lo riv. Everybody who's got a conflict, you would come to Mishpat. You would come to do Avshalom, would approach them. Where are you from? Is Me'irata? You'd say, Me'achat Shiftei Israel, I'm from somewhere, one of the cities of Israel. Where is he from? Doesn't matter. The point being that he was from random cities of Israel. Echad Shiftei Israel. random cities of Israel. Yerushalayim was a metropolis. Yerushalayim was the center of all the tribes of Israel. David intended it for that, for it to be that way, right? Yerushalayim was not divided by tribes. Yerushalayim was an ir shechubal le'yachdav. It was a united tribes of Israel all together. It was one seat of the kingdom for all of Israel. That was David's greatest contribution to Jewish history, was that he chose a city to represent all the tribes of Israel, not just his own. And we'll come to that theme in a little, in one of the future shiurim. So Vayomer me'achad shiftei Yisrael avadecha, I'm from one of the tribes of Israel, which doesn't matter. You could be from any tribe of Israel. He could be from Dan, you could be from Binyamin, you could be from Ephraim, you could be from Menashe, you could be from Yehuda, it doesn't matter. He would be in Yerushalayim, he'd be coming to the Mishpat, because that's how David had built the whole story. And Vayomer elav Avshalom, and Avshalom began to make his claim. And what's his claim based on? I, says Avshalom, I see what you're saying. I get it. I understand. I agree with you. You're right. But the king is not going to see it that way. The king is not going to agree with you. The king is not going to justify. The king is not going to hear your plea. Why? So here you have one of the most dramatic extrapolations and generalizations of Avshalom against David, but based on David's circumstances, we understand where it's coming from. In the story of frame of reference of Avshalom, David is the one who refused to intervene in the story of Amnon and Tamar. David is the one who refused to deal with Amnon and the retribution that was rightfully coming to him because of what he did to Tamar. Avshalom had to take matters into his own hands. Avshalom had to take vengeance against Amnon, rightfully or wrongfully, right? You could argue that Avshalom's method of retribution was extreme and inappropriate, especially for the courts, right? To murder him in cold blood, that's not exactly what I would call justice. But Avshalom's perspective is, David is doing nothing and I'm doing everything. And so David is gone. David is, as they say, avabatu. Time is finished. It's time for a real leader to stand up, take the reins. Says Avshalom to this poor bloke who comes, doesn't know what he's getting himself into, walks up to the courts, and Avshalom stands there, greets him, and says to him, "I'm your man." Talk about this campaign slogan, right? "I'm your man. Mi yisimeni shofet baret." You can hear it on all the placards and all the campaign slogans and all of the posters throughout Yerushalayim. Mi yisimeni shofet baret. Would that I would be the judge in the land. Let everybody come to me who has a dispute or a cause, a shiel arivu mishpat. I will give him justice. I will do him good. I will be defend his cause. It's taktiv, the defender of the oppressed class. That's Avshalom. You understand the irony of this. Right? He's guilty of treason, genocide, and regicide. Not genocide, fratricide and regicide. Killed his brother, and he killed the heir to the crown prince, and he committed treason. That's Avshalom's sense of justice. Okay, you could argue that Amnon deserved it, but that's for the courts to decide, not for him.
If you say it often enough, people will believe you.
100%. Repeat a lie often enough, and people can't tell the difference between a lie and the truth. We live in that arena today in a most dramatic form, because the ability to repeat a lie over and over again has been magnified exponentially, hundredfold in the world of the internet. So Avshalom's case, it took a little bit longer, and it took the dramatic circumstances of the background of David and Bathsheba and Amnon and Tamar. And now we can understand David. I can defend David's behavior in the case of Amnon and Tamar. I understand it. He was dealing with the avelos over his child. He was dealing with the tragedy of Bathsheba and Uriah and the critique of the Navi and the Sanhedrin that abandoned him, according to Chazal, which means that he had no authority to adjudicate anyway. I get it. Avshalom did not see any of that. Avshalom only saw the inaction, and where he stepped up, And so Vayomer Rav Shalom, mi yisifeni shofet. I will deal with this. And the last piece of the story, when this man would come and approach Avshalom to bow to him, Avshalom would set forth his hands, he would take hold of this poor man, and he would kiss him. What was he doing in this moment? What was Avshalom doing in this act of, as the man came to bow down to him, he would take him, stand him up, hug him, kiss him. What's Avshalom doing?
He was imitating King David.
Oh, we'll get to that piece in a second. That's correct, but I'll get to that in a second. I want to just understand what the act was meant to reflect. Right? What was the act meant to reflect to this person who came to the court?
That Absalom was in favor of whatever he needed or wanted. In
favor of him, and take it one step further. Why would he kiss him? Why would he hug him? He's coming to bow to the king, to the prince. Why would he, hechazikla, why would he put forth his hand and take hold of him and kiss him? So look at the Mefarshim. Look, it's unbelievable what the Mefarshim understood in this statement, right? Avshalom would put forth his hand, take hold of him and kiss him. Vayabikrav ish nishtachabop in the shakla of Yosef Kara, makes the following statement. If an ashakli would kiss him, lomar, to tell him, eini gadol mimcha, I'm not any bigger than you. I'm not greater than you. I'm talking about identification and connection. You don't have to bow down to me. I'm your brother. I'm your equal.
Sounds very populist, like a demagogue. 100%.
Hey, look at the Malbim. Kashe yishak ish et achiv. He grabbed him that he should get up and not bow down to him. And he kissed him. Like a one person kisses his brother. Talk about a mechanism by which he then stole the hearts of Israel. Because here he's the presenting himself as the next. Right? He's going to win this election. It's not an election, but he's going to win this position. And this poor guy who is, didn't know what hit him, right? This poor guy who came to bow down to the king, now suddenly the king, or the would-be king, or the next king, right? He gives him his business card, and he gives him his cell number, and he says, call me if you need anything. I'm here for you. Vechaziklo, he tells him to bow down to me. You're my equal. Vinashaklo, he kissed him. And I have this image of the king and I, kind of in the, you know, between the Anno and the king as I am, you know, this kind of conflict of the king, kind of everybody bowing down to the king, and nobody can be higher than the king's head. And Avshalom says to him, no, stand up, face me, I'll hug you, kiss you, you're my equal. I'm your brother. I'm not your king. I'm not towering over you. I'm going to be there for you. Oh, it doesn't take much. Repeat this to every person who came to the king for adjudication. And it doesn't take much to steal the hearts of Israel. Add to the fact that where is this particular individual from that Avshalom came to hold him, grab him, hug him, kiss him, identify with him, give him his cell number, give him his business card, tell him, call me whenever you need me. Where's this guy from?
One of the tribes.
Multiply that. One of the tribes, and therefore,
word gets around.
Word gets around. From one of the tribes, you get to all the tribes. Right? As I'll say, chaver chaver itle. Each person has a friend. So you make a friend out of one, you make a friend out of three, you make a friend out of six, and it grows exponentially. And before you know it, Avshalom, the popular one, Avshalom, add to it. Do not underestimate the power of Avshalom's presence. Tall, handsome, the yofi, the beauty of Avshalom, described in the previous parak, in contrast to David, who was short, who was small, who was ruddy, who was redhead, who Shaul looked at him when he first saw him as a warrior, and he said, "This is a warrior. You're going to stand up to Goliath. You're nothing. You're a pipsqueak. You're a kid." You're a 17-year-old little you know, scrawny nothing, right? That David had the both the faith and the strength of will and the skill to take down a Goliath didn't even occur to Shaul, whose strength of military strength derived from the fact that he was mishichmo v'mala gavoh mikol ha'am, taller than everybody else. And here is Avshalom, Yofi, beautiful, handsome, strong Avshalom, who took down Amnon in a fit of judgment, revenge, because Amnon had the audacity to stand up again to abuse his sister. Avshalom, who is going to be the defender of the working man of Israel, the oppressed, Rivu Mishpat, Avshalom is going to save the day. The picture here, the description of this and this process by which Avshalom slowly ingratiates himself to every person in Israel who comes to David, at the stealing of the hearts of Israel away from David. Where is David in all of this? We'll have to address. But Avshalom's role here has really been quite intense. Like a nev Avshalom at lev Anshei Yisrael. There is one additional piece to it, and that choice is what you mentioned a moment ago, which is that there's an irony in this act, that kind of the end of his ingratiating himself to the people of Israel by they coming to bow to him and his response of taking them and kissing them as an act of rebellion against David is particularly ironic, because it was precisely that act that David had employed to grant Avshalom the power that would enable him to do exactly what he's doing, which is to rebel against him. I mean, that's the lack of hakaras hatov, or the absence of any kind of gratitude or recognition when David had finally acquiesced to see Avshalom. Remember, Avshalom is guilty of murdering his brother and murdering the Bechor, murdering the crown prince, murdering David's child. The crimes of Avshalom are unforgivable. And yet David finally agrees to see him. Vayishak kamelech. Actually, go back a phrase. Vayishtachu lo al apav arza. Avshalom bows to David. Lifnei ha-melech, vayishak ha-melech la-Avshalom. And so Avshalom is the king kisses Avshalom. Hamelech. It's not David. It's the king. It's Avshalom is bowing not to his father, but vayishtachu lo al apav arza lifnei ha-melech. Vayavo al ha-melech, vayavo Yoav al ha-melech, vayaged lo, they called Avshalom in, vayavo al ha-melech, he came to the king, vayishtach lo ha-paramatzi lefnei ha-melech, vayishak ha-melech la-Avshalom. Just count how many times the word ha-melech appears in this one pasuk. 1, 2, 3, 4. Make no mistake about who David is and who Avshalom is. David is the king. David is not granting Avshalom status as the heir to the throne. David is not doing anything other than agreeing to see him, to allow him free access, to allow him back into the palace, and to give him a kiss. Call it commuting his sentence. I wouldn't even call it a royal pardon. What does Avshalom do? Avshalom turns it around as if Avshalom is now the king. Avshalom is now the heir apparent. Avshalom is now standing at the court. Avshalom is saying, "Ein lach shomea, ein lach me'et ha-melech." You have no one to hear you from the king. Avshalom is waiting for all these people to come to bow to him, lishtachavot lo, but not as the melech. He's not the king yet. The bowing to him is the prince. So he stands them on their feet and he gives them an embrace and he kisses them exactly as David had done to him, but in this case, as an act of rebellion. It's really quite frightening to see all the pieces of the of Avshalom's kind of workaround in his, what's the word I'm looking for, the guile that Avshalom uses to begin to steal away, literally to steal away. The language here is intentional. Vayganev Avshalom et lev anshei Israel, to steal the hearts of Israel. And that's the roots of the, that's how the rebellion begins.
Avshalom is a very clever man.
He is very clever. Whether David is cleverer or not, we shall see. But yes, he's very clever. I'm not sure it's clever. I think it's...
He's cunning.
He's cunning. I think he's ambitious. He's certainly ambitious.
Why?
Why? Sly. Oh, sly, you said. Sorry, Barbara, you're on mute. What did you...
Sly.
Right, he's certainly cunning, sly. I would not call it, a dignified kind of ambition.
Ruthless.
Yes, very ruthless. It's beneath the dignity of a prince of the palace to conduct himself in this fashion, and yet that's exactly what he does. I'm always struck by the contrast in this opening pasuk between David and Avshalom. David running before the ark, and Avshalom in his chariot with the people running before him. You know, that contrast is so dramatic in this story. All right, we have 10 minutes left. And in the 10 minutes left, I want to introduce you to one of the most vexing mysteries in the story of the rebellion of Avshalom. We're not going to really resolve it other than to leave it out there as a mystery. And we'll eventually, I think we'll work with a certain assumption, but nonetheless, we need to put it out there and understand what it is. The rebellion itself begins in Pasuk Zion. Vayhi miketz arba'im shana. Came to pass at the end of 40 years. Avshalom turns to the king and he says, I have an oath that I made when I to fulfill in Hebron. I need to go to Hebron. I ask permission from the king to go to Hebron. We'll talk about Hebron next week. We'll deal with all the issues related to Hebron on Tuesday of next week, not Monday. But this 40-year story is very perplexing. Remember that David only reigns for a total of 40 years. 7 years in Hebron, 33 in Yerushalayim. When is the rebellion of Avshalom? At the end of David's 40 years? So there's some parish that suggests that, in fact, the rebellion is in year 40. Trying to see if it's here. I don't see it here. That's fine. But there are those who suggest that it's taken at face value. The rebellion is in year 40 of David's reign. What's the problem with that assumption?
It would have to be a very fast rebellion.
Well, first of all, it's 5 chapters. So 5 chapters could take place within 1 year. I could live with that. But that's not the only problem.
Well, there's also the Adoniah thing that happened after that.
Adoniah happens after that. There's the remaining postscript events, which, according to our theory, happened earlier. But again, there's some years there unaccounted for. But the notion that David is 70 years old, and that David is on his deathbed in the same year that the rebellion of Avshalom takes place, this David has to be exiled from Yerushalayim, has to lead a battle against Avshalom in the mountains in the forest and the jungles of Yar Ephraim. He then has to come back to Yerushalayim, put down 2 more rebellions, one of Sheva ben Bichri and one of Shimi ben Gera. And then he has to begin the process of designating Shlomo as his heir to the throne. Shlomo is nowhere to be seen in the story. So is he born yet? Our theory is, based on our study of Batsheva, is Shlomo hasn't even been born yet. According to Chazal, he's born, he's a young child. But David has to prepare the building of the Beit HaMikdash. He has to prepare all of the architectural plans. He has to raise all the money. He has to bring on all the raw materials because he hands all that over to Shlomo in the beginning of Divrei Hayamim. So if the rebellion is happening in year 40, when is he doing all of that? So to suggest that the rebellion is in year 40 is very, very difficult. Chazal certainly weren't satisfied with that answer. And so what begins is a really fascinating conversation amongst the Mefarshim to what does this 40 years refer?
The age of Absalom?
Maybe. But that would, well, no, that wouldn't work either because Absalom is born in Hebron. So if Absalom is 40, that means that we're past the 40 years of David's reign. So that doesn't work either. So there's several possibilities. For example, the Rabag. Zvayim iketz 40 shana. Yitachen she'elu 40 shana hitchilu me'et tzmichat ha'machut b'Yisrael. The 40 years, maybe, says Rabag, is referring to the 40 years of the dynasty of the kingdom of Israel. Meaning, me'et himashach Sha'ul, when Sha'ul was anointed king. Or maybe it was when David was anointed king, because David wasn't anointed king and became king right away. David was anointed king when he was a young boy. And then he has a story of Goliath, and he enters into the service of Sha'ul, and then he serves Sha'ul for many years, and then Sha'ul goes crazy, and then Sha'ul dies eventually in battle, and then David becomes king. So, you know, David could be 15 when Sha'ul appointed him, and 30 when he becomes king of Israel, so there's 15 years in between. So, okay, so maybe it's happening 40 years from the beginning of the reign. All of this is, here's another example, Gemara and Tamura. This is sort of more the classic answer of Chazal. You need to understand there's a midrashic source that Chazal used for the chronology of all of Tanakh. It's a work known as Seder Olam Rabba. Seder Olam Rabba, Rashi quotes it often, is essentially Chazal, it's a midrash Chazal wrote to chronicle every event in Tanakh, according to how they saw it. So in that context, this 40 years is described as what? Tanya Rabbi Neroy Omer, Mishum Rabbi Yeshua, Miketz Arbaim Shana Sheshalu Lehem Melech, 40 years after they requested a king. 40 years from that chapter in Shmuel Aleph, when the people come to Shmuel and ask for a king, and Shmuel gives them a whole critique. Now, how did Chazal calculate that? So Chazal's calculation of those 40 years is very problematic. And we talked about this in Shmuel Aleph. D'tanya, we learned the following in Braita, which is the Braita of Seder Olam. That year when they asked for a king was the 10th year of Shmuel's position as the Shofet. Shmuel reigned for 10 years. 1 year he overlapped with Shaul, and Shaul reigned for 2 years. All of Machut Shaul is 2 years long. So in total, there's 3 years between that request and the end of Malchut Shaul, leaving 37 for David before this event took place. So according to Chazal, the story of Absalom's rebellion is in year 37 of David's reign. Why? Because Chazal read the last four chapters of Sefer Shmuel in sequence, even though we put them earlier, and there's a reference there to the three-year famine. So there's an extra 3 years there. The problem with this chronology is that it's based entirely on a pasuk in Shmuel Aleph, which is very problematic. It's based on this pasuk in Shmuel Aleph, which is, actually, let me just see if I have it here. Yeah. It's this pasuk in Shmuel Aleph, which is the beginning of the reign of Shaul, when he comes to the battle of Michmas against the Plishtim. And the pasuk says, "Ben shana Shaul b'malcho, u'shtei shanim malach b'Yisrael." Shaul was a year when he entered his reign, and he reigned for 2 years. You can understand right away that this cannot be taken at face value, because nobody's going to suggest that Shaul was a year old when he became king of Israel. But to make the claim that he only reigned for 2 years is also problematic. Because of those 2 years, they include all of Shaul's battles against the Plishtim, against Amalek, against Ammon and Moab and Aram and Syria. It includes a year and a half that David is hiding from Shaul when Shaul is chasing him. So Shaul is chasing him. He spends a year and a half running to the Eretz, hiding out by the Plishtim, and yet his entire reign is only 2 years. It just doesn't make any sense. So we suggested an alternative when we learned Shmuel Aleph, that calculating whatever the context of this verse to understand it probably means something like in his second year of his reign, that's when the Battle of Michmash took place. Okay, but it doesn't answer the question, how many years did Shaul reign? And then we don't have an answer to that question. But there's a certain logic to assume that Shaul, with all of his pieces, all of his wars, all of his battles, all of his chasing of David, etc., had to have been at least 10 or 15 years. An average. So if we start to put together the pieces of Shaul's reign, let's assume for the moment, let's give Shaul 10 or 15 years in total. Okay? I'm going to stop you sharing for a second. Let's give Shaul 10 to 15 years. Work through the years of David for a second. We know that David reigns for a total of 40 years. Seven of them are his first 7 years in Hebron. Then, the end of the rebellion of Ishbosheth, David gathers together the kingdom, unites them all under one banner, and he moves his capital from Hebron to Yerushalayim in year seven. 7.5 years, six and a half years he's in Hebron, then he comes to Yerushalayim in year seven. The conquest of Yerushalayim, the conquest of the Plishtim, third battle with the Plishtim, the war with Moab, the war with Hanun ben Nachash, king of Ammon, who publicly embarrassed David's soldiers, who went to the Menachem Avo, followed by the war with Moab, in which they brought in the Syrians to help Aram, followed by the second war, which took place on the Golan Heights against the entire known forces of all of the Aram armies together. All of that. Then there's the 2-year siege of Ammon led by Yoav, where David is in Yerushalayim. All of those wars, how long did that take? You can't shrink all of that into a year or two. Right? And by the end of it, David is exhausted and he's in Yerushalayim and the story of Bathsheba takes place. So I would give it at least 5 or 6 or even 7 years. You know, all those battles. So assuming for the moment, 7 years in Hebron, 5 to 7 years in the battles for Yerushalayim and the Embarons. And then we have the events of Bathsheba. The events of Bathsheba are at least 1 year for the story of Bathsheba itself, because there's a child born. Then there's the story of Amnon and Tamar, and Avshalom waits for 2 years before killing Amnon, so that's another 2 years. Then Avshalom goes into exile for 3 years. Then he comes back and he's under house arrest for 2 more years. So now I've got 7 more years in the story of the aftermath of Bathsheba. So more or less, are we somewhere in between year 20 and year 30 of David's reign? I could see the story of all of this taking place sort of 2/3 into David's life or David's reign. Year 30, more or less. 7 in Hebron, 10 in Yerushalayim and all the battles, and then the story of Bathsheba, and then the aftermath, 15 more years. Okay, so now we're somewhere in 20 to 30 years into David's reign. Add the 10 or 15 years or so of Shaul's reign, and Bigadol, it's not impossible to assume that we are somewhere in the vicinity of around 40 years since that fateful conversation Shaul had with the people of Israel. When he said to them, if you want a king, the danger involved in the king with a standing army is that he's going to put horses and chariots and men running before him. More or less, approximately 40 years later, story begins with Avshalom with the horses and the chariots and the 50 men running before him. More or less 40 years. 40 years is a generation. 40 years is Arba'im Shana Kut Bador. We spend 40 years in the desert. 40 years it takes to forget the story of the Jewish people leaving Egypt and entering into a new generation. 40 years, more or less, give or take a few, round it off, and you have the bridge between Shmuel's chastisement of the people until it actually begins to take place. That's exactly what Chazal is pointing to. So I can get to the same conclusion even if I take a circuitous route to the calculations and the chronology and work it through this way, but you end up in the same place, which is the link between Shmuel's declaration to the people and Avshalom's rebellion, which starts with exactly the same abuse that Shmuel predicted. All right, for now, that's about all we have time to address. We will continue the rest of this parak and its various pieces next week. A reminder, Monday morning will take place on Monday. Monday evening next week will take place on Tuesday. Okay, we're good? Thank you all. I hope you had a good time. Rabbi. Enjoy.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Very